The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Hey, this is Chuck Klosterman, and this is the BS Report. Usually with Bill Simmons, but not today, since Bill is still in the UK. And, you know, it's August, and when August rolls around, basically, I just start thinking exclusively about college football. So today I decided that I wanted to talk to someone just about kind of vague ideas about both kind of the current state of college, the college game, and also the future. So I decided to talk to Kirk Herbstreit, who is an analyst for ESPN and ABC, former quarterback for Ohio State. How are you doing, Kirk?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great. I assume I'm talking to you from Nashville, I'm guessing?
Is yeah, Nashville, Tennessee. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, I want to get right to this, okay? The first thing that I want to ask you about is the dominance of the SEC, which is something that everyone sort of concedes now. There's really not a question about it. There seems to be two prevailing theories as to why this has happened, that why this one conference has become so much more dominant. The first is that simply has the best recruiting base, and the best high school football is being played in the Southeast, and particularly in Florida. The second, which I kind of find more intriguing, is the idea that what makes the SEC different than the other conferences is that they seem to take their best athletes and avoid the temptation of making them into skill players, and instead playing them on defense. So when they end up playing teams from around the country, their defensive units just seem so much faster and more dominant. I'm curious if you believe that either of those theories has weight, and what else could explain why there's such a difference between what seemingly happens in the SEC and with every other conference in the country?
Well, first, I agree. I think we've seen this trend growing, not just in their six straight national championships, but you know, since I was a youngster, this has always been a huge debate. And I think as much as the BCS created controversy, one thing that it definitely did for college football fans is it put everybody into the same pool. You know, the bowl coalition before, the Pac-10, but then the Pac-10 and the Big Ten, were tied into the Rose Bowl and kind of left out of, you know, in Nebraska, Miami, Oklahoma, whoever happened to match up in a Fiesta Bowl or Orange Bowl for a national championship. Well, when we went to the BCS, everybody obviously was included. So if you're an SEC fan, you paid attention to the Big Ten and the Pac-12, and you paid attention to the Big 12. You paid attention to everything, and every fan base did. And so that's when I think this debate really started to get emotional and really heated. And I think it really came to a head in 2006 when Ohio State and Michigan were playing at 1-2 at the end of the year. And Ohio State ended up winning the game in Columbus. I think it was like 42-39. It was the day after Bo Schembechler had passed. And they went on to play in the national championship. And there was a big debate about who they should play. Should they have a rematch with number 2 Michigan or play Florida? And obviously they ended up playing Florida. Well, after a big debate, Florida went on to destroy Ohio State. Mm-hmm. And Michigan, if you remember, played USC in the Rose Bowl, and they got embarrassed as well. And I think it's from 06 on, the SEC has kind of flexed its muscle. And the one conference that used to think it could compete with the SEC, the Big Ten, kind of has taken a major step or two in the other direction. So now you clearly have the SEC up at the top. And I think getting back to your reasons, I think you've hit on a couple things. I think number one, if you follow recruiting and you follow the states of Florida and Louisiana and Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, even if you go even over to Texas, you would find that the SEC does a very good job of recruiting in this area. And majority of their rosters are made up of players from these regions. So they're able to keep their homegrown talent, And to be honest with you, I just think there's a different mindset. I lived in Columbus, Ohio, and before that near Dayton and Cincinnati, Ohio, my whole life until last year. And when I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, and that's not even further down into Louisiana or Georgia, but there's just a different mindset about the importance of high school football and college football when you get down into the South. And I really believe that these players grow up with a mindset of going on to play and represent Alabama, Georgia, LSU, Florida, whoever it happens to be. And that's a big passion, not only theirs, but their families and their high school coaches. And it's very difficult for Ohio State or Michigan or anybody else, for that matter, to come down and get the high-profile players out of that area.
Well, this might be somewhat related, I guess, to this question. There's a lot of talk now, of course, about concussions and how that's really affecting parents who have a 10- or 12-year-old kid.
Sure.
Should they allow him to play football? And it's very odd. I have all of these friends now with kids who love football but are very straightforward about they don't feel comfortable with their kid playing a collision sport. But will that never happen in the same way in the Southeast? If football changes everywhere else in the country...
No, it won't happen.
Never. it wouldn't matter what the evidence is in your mind.
No, and I'm a good one to ask because I have 12-year-old twin boys and a rising, soon-to-be 10-year-old boy. And, I pay attention as much as anybody to the discussions about the concussions and the trauma, the head trauma, and where does it start and that type of thing. I believe, and I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I watch these games at that level, and the one thing I really recognize is that kids are not hitting. That age group is not necessarily making the kind of impact that you're going to see at obviously the high school level where you go up to college and then eventually pro. So I've felt pretty comfortable, me personally, with my kids playing. It's something they want to do. I would never encourage anybody to force their kids to play anything, for that matter. But if your kids are really interested in playing and you've got good coaching and pretty solid set of rules to prevent some concerns, I personally don't have a huge problem with it. I think sometimes as a society we have a knee-jerk reaction to certain things. But the contact isn't anywhere close to...
But isn't the fear, though, now that there might be tiny concussions with every headshot and that it's this kind of a building of over time? I mean, I agree with you for the most part. I am curious, though, if your kid had got two concussions as a freshman, would that be it for you? Would you say probably no more football for you?
You know what? I don't know. I'd have to. It depends, like you said, what is a concussion? Because anybody who's played football has had their bell rung, and you see a few little stars, and you just kind of keep going. You're just conditioned that way. Mm-hmm. You don't want to lose your job. You don't want to lose a rep. You just keep playing. And I'm not talking the age of 10 and 11, 12, but when you get into middle school and high school.
Yes.
So that's the way you're conditioned as an athlete. And you're right, is that a concussion? I mean, some doctors are saying that is considered a small concussion, and over time those can add up. I have a dad who played when they didn't wear face masks, and, he has a lot of peers that played in that era. And, I think that I'm a huge fan of the fact that we're studying, that the doctors now in the NFL, who always seem to set the bar for everybody else, that they're now really paying attention to this and they're really concerned about this. And the more data that comes in and the research that they're able to bring into this, I think is healthy. So I'm a huge fan and advocate of bringing as much information to the surface as possible. But at the same time, I think you have to be careful of, it's like, gee, should I get in a car today? Because the studies say that...
That's not really a valid comparison. Have to drive. Football is something that we choose to do. It is interesting you mention your father, though, because even though it seems insane, what do you make of people who speculate that if there were no face masks, if they played with a helmet without a face mask, this problem disappears because no one is going to lead with their head if they don't have that sort of protection.
That's a good point.
I mean, it would be a different game.
It would be.
I can't imagine head-to-head collisions, though, if there was a risk it could hit your nose or your face.
Well, some guys are crazy enough that they wouldn't even care. But, you know, if you ever stayed up late enough and just flipped through certain sports stations and you found the rugby that's over in New Zealand and Australia, I mean, those guys don't have any equipment on and they're throwing.
Not much head-to-head contact, though.
Yeah, well.
It's not the same.
Sometimes I see guys with their heads wrapped around like they've been in a war. So, I mean, there is some kind of collisions going on there. But you're probably right. I mean, I don't think we'll ever see the NFL or any league, for that matter, go back to that because
it seems too crazy. But I can see the logic.
But you could make a strong argument that hey, if you take the face mask off, nobody's going to be leading with their head. Other than doing that, I think what the NFL is doing, and I know it's driving players, especially the older generation, the old school guy, crazy by saying, "Oh my gosh, what are you going to do next? You know, just have us play flag football." But if you really think about it, it's when they lead with their heads, and those are the big hits. And what's crazy is these safeties and linebackers who have been trained their whole lives to separate a receiver who's up in the air, makes a catch. The one way you can separate him from the football is to lead with your head and drill him, preferably in the chest, but sometimes it slips up into the face mask, and you can knock a guy silly. And, of course, that's what leads SportsCenter. And you know, we go crazy about those big hits, and at the end of the year, we have the hits of the year package, and all the fans really love it, and everybody gets excited about it. But that's what the NFL is talking about. And so, on one hand, we're celebrating these hits, and on the other hand, we're penalizing and, in some cases, fining players for these hits. And I think it's really from the culture of our society today versus what the rules are, it's really sending these players a mixed message, because on one hand we're saying, hey, if you hit a guy like this, everybody's going to be talking about it and you're going to get a sticker on your helmet, and on the other hand, you're going to be fined or you're going to be kicked out of the game if you do it. So it's a messy situation. It's going to be very interesting to see how Roger Goodell and even down in the college game, how the leadership handles this, because I know from talking to players, it's very, very frustrating aspect of the game that they have to deal with.
Well, do you sense that now offensive coordinators are realizing how this is changing the game? I wonder if sort of the new rise, especially at the pro level, or the return of tight ends, has to do with the fact that if you have, like, you know, a big tight end like the Patriots do or the Saints, and there's no risk of him being cut in half over the middle, it makes it a very kind of a reasonable kind of attack. You know, I see these teams like the Colts are going to a two tight end set now. I mean, do you think that offensive coordinators are aware that because that they're limiting sort of like the Jack Tatum type player, that there are new ways to attack defenses that they really have no way to respond to?
Well, especially in the NFL, where the best way to communicate the way quarterbacks play, especially when you're starting referring to Tom Brady and Drew Brees. I mean, if you sit down and play Madden, that's essentially how accurate guys like Drew Brees and Tom Brady are. So to be able to get a tight end like Jimmy Graham or Gronk going vertically down into the teeth of a defense, and you know that if you just put it high, he's going to go up and make a play, and if anybody dares to put a head-to-head hit on him, that it's not only going to be potentially a catch and 15 more yards, but you might get a player kicked out of the game. I mean, I don't know if they would ever admit that publicly, but when you have a quarterback who can literally put the ball on the left shoulder, the right shoulder, or anywhere he wants, and I don't know if necessarily you said that, you know, they don't have to be concerned about a player getting taken out. I still think these safeties cannot get it into their minds that I have to lay off. I still think these guys in their minds think it's worth the 15 yards. I don't care. I'm going to hit this guy as hard as I can and roll the dice and see if I get called for it. I think too many of these guys have been playing the game for so long that it's almost like, you know, you got to reprogram your computer in your mind. And when the game is moving as fast as it does, it's very, very hard to do something. Oh my gosh, that's right! And when it's literally happening in a tenth of a second, you have to make a decision on what to do. And a lot of times, you just go by muscle memory and instincts. And you know, it's easy to think, gosh, you know the rule, lay off. And yet these guys do not do it. If anything, they just continue to hit people harder and harder. It's almost their way of boycotting the rule, and they could care less if it affects their team or if they get a penalty for it.
Well, it does seem, though, like guys are getting seriously hurt more often in these games, though, where there's like the stoppage of play. You don't think that the culture is changing at all?
Well,
in that
I think
way?
The younger generation, it could be changing. And I also think there's a difference between Roger Goodell saying, we've instructed our officials to penalize you for this, this, and this, and, you know, you're half asleep in a meeting, I got you. Then you get into a game, and they start calling it and calling it and calling it. Then you have an entire off season to go to OTAs and to go to mini camps and to finally get to camp. And maybe there's a different way that you'd have to talk to defensive coordinators in the league. Maybe there's a different way that they're hitting these guys over and over and over and over with how to address a ball that's thrown down the middle. If a guy's hit, you know, is throwing the ball here, you're used to doing this. Now you're going to be trained to do this. Maybe after seeing how serious Roger Goodell is over these last couple of years, maybe this year we'll see guys, as you said, willing to lay off. But based on the games that I watch, if anything, and some of the quotes I hear from some of these players, it's almost their way of kind of thumbing their nose at the commissioner, saying, "Hey, you know, who do you think we are? We're not going to lay off." So maybe this year it'll be different after a year of trying to see how serious this commissioner seems to be in the NFL, anyway.
Getting back to what we were talking before, you had sort of mentioned the Big Ten in passing, and it always seems like the Big Ten is in some sort of competitive peril. I'm curious, though, if you think this is a possibility. I mean, for a conference to return as a real power conference, it sort of needs to have a national champion, someone, or at least the possibility that the best team in that league can be the best team in the country. With the terrible thing that happened to Penn State, it does seem like Ohio State now is going to dominate that recruiting battle in Pennsylvania. And the fact that Urban Meyer is now the coach there, I think, will sort of give them a higher national profile. Does it seem possible to you that Ohio State could win a national championship in 2 years, in 3 years? Or do they still seem sort of, you know, because they're year in and year out the best team there. Do they still seem to you athletically disadvantaged compared to the SEC or maybe USC?
Well, I think time will tell. I know that's Urban Meyer's stated goal. It's not just to compete for Big Ten championships, but coming out of the SEC, he wants to be able to get into bowl games with the SEC, national championships, and not just get there, but beat them. I'd also make a pretty strong argument for Brady Hoke. I think what he's doing, if you follow recruiting pretty closely, I mean, they're lighting it up. He had a great year last year recruiting. They're off to a huge start again for next year. I would guess, if we're sitting here kind of forecasting and looking into a crystal ball, I would say that Ohio State and Michigan both are on the verge of really starting to gather up a lot of high-profile players. They're going to get them back to competing for national championships. You know, and the other thing you have to combine with that, it's not like they're getting through the SEC. You look at Ohio State's schedule and Michigan's schedule, and once they get completely loaded, you make a strong argument that they'll be favored in 11 or 12 games that they play, with the exception of playing one another, because they're going to be so much further along than most of their peer group. So it's not just about getting there, though. I think for those two teams, I think it's being able to compete and do well. But yeah, I would say in the next couple of years, without a doubt, I think you'll see a very, very high level of athletic ability surfacing on both sides of the ball for both of those teams, and it's just a matter of catching a few breaks and getting to those championship games. But I think both teams will be ready to compete.
Okay, so moving forward then, starting with this year, moving kind of maybe a 5-year trajectory, what conference is better positioned to become the second power conference? Is it the Big Ten for the reasons you described, or is it the Pac-12? Because when you look, like, they've really got a lot of great coaches over there. Now, like, Mike Leach is at Washington State, Rich Rod is at Arizona, Sarkisian's at Washington. Obviously, USC seems like they could potentially win the national championship this year. Oregon is always going to be, as long as Kelly is there, going to be a factor. Which conference do you think will kind of fit in as number two when we start looking at all these? Or is the Big 12 still part of this discussion?
Well, what's ironic about the Big 12 is they've lost all these teams, and they brought in West Virginia and TCU, and you start to look at the teams based on at least some of the research I've done, and you can make a really strong case that these guys might have more depth this year than they've had in the past, and only having 10 teams and taking out some pretty powerful programs, you know, along the way. So I guess I look at, I would say, when you get into the debate about who has the premier conference, what's imperative is your bell cows, your premier conferences, have got to be able to do well. And if Ohio State and Michigan end up going and kind of, as I said, trending and heading in a direction that, that many people think, the image of that conference, very similar to like Alabama and LSU, would help their cause. I would not sell Brett Bielema short in what he's doing at Wisconsin. Mark D'Antonio and the job that he's doing right now at Michigan State. Those two programs, the last couple years, not just last year, but the last few years, have done an outstanding job. The Pac-12, the jury is out. We have finally USC back. Lane Kiffin, I think, is going to do a great job. You mentioned Chip Kelly. As long as he's there, they're going to recruit speed. They're always going to be up there. But is UCLA ever going to get back into the fold? Is Washington with Steve Sarkisian, are they on their way of getting to an elite level, not just, you know, winning 8 or 9 games, but an elite level? So, you know, I'd love to see UCLA get back with Jim Mora. They've, you know, it's funny, you talk to Pac-12 players and coaches off the record, and whenever I ask them, okay, just forget records, just pure personnel. Give me your top 2 or 3 teams in the Pac-12. Inevitably, one team that's always on that list is UCLA.
How can that be, though?
I have no idea.
It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. But that goes back to going since I first started doing this. I love to talk to guys about that just to kind of see what they think. And essentially, that's basically telling me that UCLA has personnel, and maybe Jim Mora can come in and do some things with them. And you know, if you can get UCLA and USC – and Oregon going, now that starts to really, I think, have an impact on, again, changing the image. And the other thing that...
Well, is there still a bias about the physicality in the Pac-12, or is that over?
No, the bias is, and it's because I see it, is the fact that they're on the West Coast. And they can do whatever they want to do, but there's a reality where the fans and certain media members don't see Pac-12 football. And when you don't see Pac-12 football, if you don't watch it, you just catch scores or highlights, you don't have an appreciation for that conference. And so I would say of all the conferences that going into this debate are kind of at a disadvantage, it would definitely be the Pac-12 because it's tougher for fans to either stay up and watch the game.
Well, they have a relationship with Fox now, right? Isn't it going to be easier to see Pac-12 games?
Yeah, that definitely will help them. I think their high-profile games will be easy to catch, but it's still a time thing. You know, you have at your typical fan that is plugged into teams that start at noon Eastern and they play at 3:30 at Eastern, they play at, you know, 7 or 8 o'clock Eastern. Those teams and those fans are dialed into that. And then, you know, you're right, Fox or ABC, whoever covers the high-profile Pac-12 game will get some attention. And that's, I think, what Larry Scott's doing is addressing this. But it's still a reality of just the time. And dealing with that is something that they're always going to have to try to compete against. But I think Larry Scott at least is being proactive with some of his partnerships and some of the things that they're trying to do, which will help them in the long run.
You know, we talked about Oregon there briefly. When you look at the style that they play, and say the style that Oklahoma State plays or whatever, do you see this as a trend, and that this will just be something that certain teams are doing and succeeding at, and then there'll be a way to stop it, and it will end? Or will the idea of playing faster just kind of be adopted wholesale? Because it makes sense for a whole bunch of reasons.
And I talk with defensive coordinators about that all the time, and... You know, typically what you see, you know, what started years ago with the spread was teams that maybe had inferior talent and they needed something to kind of even the playing field a bit. So they went to the spread and they found, you know, ways to get the defense spread from sideline to sideline. Then you go recruit a quarterback that can run and throw and he goes back and makes some plays and you can win some games. But then everybody started to do it and everybody started to kind of realize how successful it could be. Well, then Oklahoma really kind of raised the bar along with Chip Kelly. And now Oklahoma State, and you could go down through the list of teams that are doing this. And at this point, defensive coordinators at the highest level are really struggling with what to do against that kind of situation. Now, We saw Auburn handle it to a certain degree against Oregon, but I don't think that was them dealing with tempo as much as it was just Nick Fairley and a superior defensive line overpowering Oregon. Now, Oregon threw for over 300 yards in that game, and they moved the ball, but it wasn't their typical Oregon attack, up-tempo, run the ball with Michael James and Kenyon Barner, and then mix in some pass. It was more, hey, they're taking our run away because they're beating us up front. We got to throw the ball.
Well, it does seem, this was true when Oregon played LSU, I think, at the beginning of last year. The key to stopping that does seem to be first down. If you stop the team on first down, they're in second and 12, then they have to slow down and get a good play because they don't want to get into third and 12. That seems to be the only reason. Because I don't know, it's not as though the plays they're running are so complex. It really is just almost a philosophical thing.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, you're right. If you can slow them down, which by the way, good luck in doing, especially when you're playing against the speed of Oregon. In Oregon's case, and not looking at Oklahoma State or Oklahoma or any of the others, in Oregon's case, the one thing that they still have a disadvantage with, and we'll see if it changes this year, is the offensive line. Their offensive line when they played Ohio State, their offensive line when they played LSU, and their offensive line when they played Auburn, the three games, and at times USC, the games and the teams that when they match up, they really don't have an answer for that defensive line. And so they'd get a few negative plays here and there, which is rare for them. If you're allowing, as you said, them to pick up first downs, they go into warp speed, and you really don't have much of a chance to slow them down. To me, the defensive line and getting penetration is the only way you can stop Oregon and the only way you can hope to be able to get them into those, not just second and 12, but it's really getting them into that third and 8 situation, third and 7, third and 8, when you know they're going to pass. But they still, I think, feel pretty confident about the direction and the way they're heading this year. But it is fun. Getting back to your question as far as the speed and the tempo, Urban Meyer gets back into college football coaching. He went all around the country just in case he did get back. And talking to all the coaches, one of the things that really stood out to him was Chip Kelly and the up-tempo offense. So sure enough, he gets to Ohio State. Goes out, hires a staff. The first thing he tells his offensive coordinator, we're going to do this up-tempo stuff, and we're going to crank it. And we got a great quarterback to be able to do it. So here's Urban Meyer coaching at a school where he can recruit linemen and tailbacks and anything else he wants. You'd think if there's ever a guy that's going to run I formation and play defense and special teams, it's Urban Meyer. And Urban Meyer is not going to do that. Urban Meyer is going to play fast tempo, 85 snaps a game. And that's a perennial power, like Ohio State going to that style. So when you start to see teams like that, as opposed to just a team that needs to do something to be able to level that playing field, that starts to tell you that it's a trend. And the only way that trend will stop is when defenses, if they ever do, communicate in the off season, hey, this is what we do, this is how we handle it. You know, the substitution is this way and that way. Because that's what happens. These defensive linemen get worn out when you have to defend this. And when defensive linemen get worn out, then you literally have no chance of stopping that offense. And the tempo, the speed of it, is built just to wear down the defensive line and get them with their hands on their hips. And once Oregon sees that, teams like Oregon see that, they're going to score in a matter of two or three more plays. Because that's at that point, then it becomes backyard football, and that's when they really can make you pay for it.
Okay, from a style of play perspective, which of these three statements do you think is most accurate? That the college game is getting closer to the pro game, that the pro game is getting closer to the college game, or the difference is actually growing and it's wider than it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago?
I would probably say option C. The only reason I say that, I know that in the NFL we see the wildcat, which to me, when I watch the NFL and I hear them say wildcat, I mean, more often than not, now maybe it'll be different, with, Cam Newton, what he's doing at Carolina or RG3 or, when you actually have a quarterback in there who can throw the ball. But for the most part, the wildcat in the NFL is a running back who doesn't read anything and he just flashes the ball and then he runs the ball. You're not reading. In college, you're reading every single snap. So it's very, very different. But if you go back 10 or 15 years ago, almost everybody, except for the crazy whack, was running an I formation offense. Almost everybody was running stuff that would filter down from the NFL. I mean, to look at college offenses, I mean, for that matter, go to watch a high school game, good high school football programs. Everybody is in a shotgun. Every single high school offense and majority of college offenses earn a shotgun.
Well, yeah, I remember a few years ago when Ball State had that good quarterback. Wasn't one of the issues when he was a freshman is that he had never taken a snap under center?
Yeah,
and it took
absolutely.
Him a year. Oh, I can't remember his name off the top of my head now, but
Do
you watch a lot of high school football?
Yeah, I do. I think his name was Nate Davis.
Yes, there he is. There you go.
Yeah. He was a guy who came in out of Bel Air High School out of Eastern Ohio, in the Ohio River, and right off the Ohio River. And he was a fantastic high school player. He fit in perfectly with what they wanted to do, and they implemented his skill set into being really successful in college.
What else do you see happening at the high school level? I find this really fascinating. And are there certain regional trends you see?
Yeah, especially in the South. You know, in the South, they can have spring football. And I don't know all the rules of each state, but when you can have spring football, that gives you another, 10 practices? Well, I don't know the rules, 10 or 15 practices, but they get introduced things. And I'll tell you, the biggest difference in high school football today from, let's say, when you and I were in high school is the way the quarterbacks and the receivers execute and the running backs, the skill, the offensive skill, and the way they throw the football, because they're trained at a much younger age, at a much higher level, and these guys are working at it, you know, year round. When I was a kid, we played baseball, then
yes.
You played basketball, then you played baseball.
That's actually a really disappointing thing, though.
I agree completely.
I mean, I hate that.
I agree completely.
Like, I feel like the quarterback should play shortstop. He should play point guard.
He should be the point guard. Everywhere I go, these parents, unfortunately, are listening. I call it the Earl Woods syndrome. You know, or we see the video of Earl. Here's Tiger. He's 5 years old. And he's got his golf club. And this wave of parents, you know, from the last probably 10 or 15 years, they saw that and they think, I got to get my kid. Get him in a golf club. We got to. All right, he's a shortstop. We're gonna play baseball 12 months out of the year. To me, what they don't realize is number one, he's gonna have a hell of a little league career. He's gonna be burnt out. And he's not even gonna play high school ball. Every coach I get a chance to talk to as a dad myself with four young boys, because I'm thinking, am I missing something here? I talk to all of them about, you know, listen, all these parents are playing one sport and they're just working it, and that one sport they're really good at, but they don't play anything else. And every one of them I've ever talked to says it's the worst mistake they can make. Play every new season, play a new sport, because at the end of the road, we want to all-around athlete who enjoys some fun experiences and competing at a high level in other sports. And at the end of the day, it's going to make you a better soccer player or a better football player or a better baseball player or whatever, or hockey.
Well, I think it also really changes the perception of sports for the kid, who then believes that there must be some next level that makes it a success. That if I'm only going to play baseball, the reason I'm doing this is in order to play professional baseball or play college baseball or get a scholarship. I think that's very odd, because it's such a hopeless dream, even if the kid's
absolutely.
A great athlete.
You're exactly right. Yeah. But unfortunately, we celebrate the Bryce Harpers of the world. I mean, Bryce Harper, you go back and look at his life, and God bless him, he ended up making it. But for every Bryce Harper, there's thousands of other kids that don't make it. And yet they're looked at from parents and from little league coaches and whoever else as, this guy's going to make it. Hey, this guy made it, and this guy made it here in this same program. So if you do this, you got a really good shot of making it. You're exactly right. I mean, I think whatever happened to just enjoying the process, enjoying the experience and bouncing around from sport to sport and just being a kid. You know, you go out and look at these parks and these ballparks, and nobody's playing anything. Everything is organized. It's like, I got my hitting coach from 10 to 2, my speed coach from 2 to 3, you know, and on down the line. That's the way kids of today, that's what they're growing up with. So going back to, what do we see with high school football today? If you're focused just on football, these quarterbacks are throwing the ball better. These 7-on-7 things that are all over the country, and it's almost become AAU-like, where they go out and they travel around and they try to get scholarships. The receivers run better routes. The running backs are bigger and stronger and faster. And everybody's running some version of a spread, shotgun formation. Quarterbacks are back there just throwing the ball all over the park. And consequently, they can throw it good. And when they get up to college, a lot of times that's the offense that they've already run most of their high school career. And then if they're lucky enough to go to the next level, Now it's like, what? I got to put my hand where? Down here? I got to drop back there? I'd rather just, I've been there for the last 8 years. Can't I just line up back there, 5 yards back?
Where do you see the most interesting high school football being played now?
Well, it depends on how you say interesting.
Interesting in that they're running things offensively and defensively, and they're playing styles that to you seems new.
I think it's Texas. You know, I from everybody I've talked to and from film that I've looked at, Texas and California and Florida. Not only do you have the best players, but I think you have coaches who are on the cutting edge as far as the latest trends. You know, when you go into places like Ohio and Western Pennsylvania, I think there's such tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's still some coaches that are probably throwing it around, but a lot of times that's more grinded out, tough, hard nose.
I guess my question is this: when you say that about Texas, what are some things you're seeing in Texas high school football that hasn't even moved up to the college level yet?
Well, I don't know if it hasn't moved up to the college level yet, but I just think that if you go back to South Lake Carroll, for example, was a suburb outside of Fort Worth, and I believe it was Todd Dodge who was there, and then he eventually got the head job at North Texas. He had Chase Daniel, who's now a backup for Drew Brees with the New Orleans Saints. And I remember talking to Chase about what he was doing at Missouri, and he said, I ran this exact same offense when I was at Southlake. And Greg McElroy, by the way, went to that same high school too. And he said, so when I got to Missouri, I didn't have to learn anything. It was like it's just the next year of playing high school football. And so when you go back to when we were coming out of high school football, I mean, are you kidding me? It was like you went from just the lowest level to all of a sudden, it's like trying to just get through some kind of basic math class, and now here's calculus, when you try to learn a college offense and defenses. And here's Chase Daniel leaving a high school offense, and he's looking at it as a freshman saying, oh, yeah, I know this. Oh, yeah, no problem, make this throw. And I think that you're going to see that throughout the state of Texas, because what Texas high school football coaches do is they really, really research this. I mean, this is obviously something they live and breathe every single day. And they're talking to people like Mac Brown, and they're trying to get into Texas A&M with Kevin Sumlin, and they're trying to find out, what about this? What do you do with that? And these coaches are opening their doors and saying, hey, this is our philosophy. This is what we do. And then they implement that, and they, they trim it down and allow the high school teams, high school players pick it up. But, you're seeing high school offenses run college style offenses in the state of Texas, and I think it allows them, the quarterbacks and receivers, to step in and play right away without a doubt.
Okay, this is kind of a strange question. It might have an obvious answer or maybe no answer, but we often talk about, say, guys like Reggie Bush, who are these extremely dominant, outstanding collegiate players, and they go to the NFL. And then the game is different, and they're not as dominant. The speed of the game is different. Or somebody like Colt Brennan, who puts up these huge numbers in Hawaii, and maybe he can't make all the throws at the professional level. That sort of makes intuitive sense. What I'm always confused about is when the opposite happens. Like, why is someone like Arian Foster, who had a good but not great career at Tennessee, but is now probably the best, at least statistically, back at the pro level? I guess Tom Brady would be the ultimate example of this, who was almost immediately a better pro than a collegiate. Why do some guys, very, very few, but some, seem more designed to play against better competition at a higher level than they did as collegiates?
I really don't think you can sit there and say, this is the reason why that happens. I think that each example, there's maybe a different story. Foster, I remember when he played at Tennessee, he was a good player.
He had like a good junior year, and he didn't even get drafted.
Yeah,
that seems very
and
bizarre.
Again, I don't know him well enough to know if he had issues with a coach. I don't know if it was just he went through some tough times and lean years at Tennessee. I don't know if he got in some trouble when he was at Tennessee. I don't know. Behind closed doors, what went on in his career. He obviously has the physical ability to be an outstanding back, and he plays with a great deal of emotion, now that he plays for the Texans. Why was it not in Knoxville? I don't have an answer for you. I mean, I know that if the team were playing better, it probably he would have been the beneficiary, having a better line and better receivers and a better quarterback, and voila, he probably would have had a pretty good year, pretty good career when he was at Tennessee. So I just think that there are different reasons that all of a sudden the light goes off. Maybe guys mature a little bit. Maybe they grow up. Maybe they weren't as focused as they needed to be when they were in college, and they kind of got distracted by things that were irrelevant to their careers and their growth. And I think that, all of a sudden they realize, wow, this is my last chance. I got to be able to pay for the bills, and this is my dream. I'm right there. And all of a sudden, maybe they crank it up another notch.
I suppose also it's like it is a job now they can do 9 hours a day. So if they have the physical skills, someone can just refine those skills to do these things repetitively over and over again.
But I also just think it's sometimes an attitude adjustment. I'm not saying that's the case with Foster, but sometimes guys, just so you know, and you probably know this, high school football players, they're what drives them is to make it to the NFL. You know, the fact that, you know, they get caught up in their 3 or 4 years while they're in college, but you go back to the way the game used to be played and how you used to recruit players, and it's very, very different today. I mean, you're pushing, you know, how competitive you are to win championships and how often you're on TV and how, hey, look, there's one guy at your position, you're going to be able to get on the field right away. And, oh, by the way, the last 5 guys that played your position, four of them were first-rounders. And that's like bing, 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 bing. I mean, that's what drives them. So when they get into college, it takes a really good coach, in my mind, to be able to put those individual goals of NFL, NFL money, NFL lifestyle, NFL, 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 from an 18-year-old, somehow put that on the back burner. And for now, I need you to buy into what we are about, and that is winning. And if you don't get your carries or you don't get your yards or your receiver and you don't get a chance to catch 10 catches and we still win, I need a smile on your face and I need you to be happy. I've seen guys that have had the team wins. They have 2 catches for 12 yards. They walk out of the locker room and you'd think they lost by 30 points. I've seen guys have 10 receptions for 160 yards and the team lost and they walk out thinking that the team won. A good coach recognizes that. A good coach is able to communicate in a way that, and as much as Nick Saban takes criticism from fans about, oh, he thinks he's a god and all this, one thing he does is he sets a standard for his players. And they all have those same goals that everybody else has, but why they're in Tuscaloosa, they will be part of winning an SEC championship, and that's the mindset, and winning a national championship. And if you somehow get that mixed up and it's about you getting drafted, you're not playing. You can stand right over there. The next guy's in line. And I really applaud that and admire that about him. And I wish more coaches kind of had that mindset of this is why you're here and this is what we're going to do. I think younger players sometimes think it's all about making plays and being recognized. It really starts with winning. When you win, that's what gets recognized, and that's when individual attention gets really rewarded. But sometimes players, I think, have it reversed.
I want to ask you just a couple more things, and then I'll let you go. The first thing I want to ask you about, I guess, doesn't really come into play until 2014, because it's a question about the collegiate playoffs, but I have a feeling that this is going to be a conversation that we have a lot when this actually happens. We don't even know yet how the teams will necessarily be selected for this 14 playoff, but if you ran things, how would you perceive this situation? A team from the SEC has one loss. You know, Texas has one loss. Oregon has one loss. The best team in the Big Ten has one loss. And a team from the MAC is undefeated. Would you think to yourself, well, if they're the only undefeated team, they need to be in this 4-team playoff? Or would you say, well, we still have to look at it the way we used to, which is sort of this kind of attempt to rationally figure out who is the best team based on who they always are as much as what they did? You know, would a undefeated MAC team, or say a team like Houston, if they went undefeated, to you, would they warrant being in a 4-team playoff if there were a bunch of other one-loss teams from power conferences?
First off, college football is subjective in its system. It is in the BCS, and it will be in the 4-team playoff. And when you have that kind of situation, you have a lot of gray area where you might let's say you're on the selection committee and I'm on the selection committee, and you might have your own set of rules and ideas about what you think is fair, and I might have my own set of rules, not what I think is fair, and you're voting and I'm voting, and that's the way things are. In the NFL, it's very clear at the beginning of the year, this is the rule, and if you qualify and you're a wild card team, here are the tiebreakers, and if you qualify, congratulations, shake your hand, we'll see you next week in a playoff game. If not, and you're 8-8 and the other team's 8-8 and they go, sorry, you knew the rules, see you later, your season's over. And no one argues about it. It's the rules. In our world, it's subjective. So guys like you, guys like me, we talk about these teams, we get people upset, we get people excited. Here's what I do. I watch games. That's the only thing I can recommend. And taking your scenario is impossible to be able to give you an answer, because I pay attention from week one to the first week in December, and who you're playing and where you're playing them goes into my thought process when I'm looking at teams. An example, Michigan plays Alabama in Dallas week one this year. What are they, 7, 8, 9? I don't even know where they are to start off the year, but they're in the top 10. Alabama's at number 2. In my mind, if Michigan goes to Dallas, and let's not say for argument's sake they win the game, but let's say they compete, Denard Robinson's making plays, it comes down late, Michigan ends up losing 24-20. If I'm voting that next week, Michigan goes from wherever they are this week, 7 or 8, wherever they are, they go up to 4 or 5 for me. Unfortunately, we've all been trained, well, they lost, they go down 4 or 5 spots. The team behind them beat Arkansas State by 80. They're going to go up.
This has always been your policy, I feel like.
Yeah, I can't stand this. And so everybody's caught up in what do you do if there's an SEC with one loss, Big Ten, Pac-12, what do you do? What you do is you hope that the selection committee takes their job seriously. And when you watch the game, if we're going to live in this subjective world,
you have to
watch and be able to tell a difference between not just a score, but did you watch the atmosphere? Did you see what they had to overcome? I don't care if, let's say, Alabama wins 20-17 against a team like Mississippi State. If it's in Starkville and the crowd is hostile and all that, you got to take that into consideration. That's the thing for me. So I would have a hard time moving a MAC team ahead of any of those other four teams.
Here's my counter-argument to that, though. It's, okay, it is a subjective world. That's true. It's definitely been that way in college football, you know, up through now. I don't actually, I think the BCS is probably does a better job than most people do. I kind of liked the old system. But if we're moving to a playoff system, the idea is to make it less subjective. It is to sort of take that out and play it down. And if that is the case, and we're going to say it's possible for a team to go undefeated and not qualify for that tournament, it's almost like telling them, concentrate on basketball. It seems to me a 4-team playoff is not, like an 8-team playoff, that would be a little different because I can't imagine an undefeated team not being included in the top 8. But if you're trying to play these things down, and I don't know why it's so important to people to have a clear champion, but if that is their desire, how can you take a team that doesn't lose and say you're not even part of you don't even get an attempt at this?
No, and that's a fair argument. And that's why I said it's so hard to be able to sit there and say, okay, I would definitely say this team, and that team. Like the Miami of Ohio team with Ben Roethlisberger, that you're looking at a MAC team. Imagine the run that they made that year. I can't remember where they finished. So it is very difficult to sit here and say I would definitely put them in because they're undefeated and they deserve it, or I would definitely leave them out. I would look at it and say, I'm looking for the top 4 teams. This team I know for sure. I've watched them. They're, in my opinion, that's the best team I've seen all year. This team, last year, did you feel like Alabama was one of the top 2 teams? Forget about what your own philosophy might be on winning a conference championship. You and I may disagree on that. Put that to the side. Were they one of the top 2 teams last year in your mind?
Was Alabama? Yes.
Okay. So – if that's what we're saying the system is about, then the same people that are saying, well, if there's a MAC team that's undefeated, they have to be in the championship, are probably the same people saying Alabama should have won their conference championship to be able to qualify. And see, what I'm saying is the only thing that's come out of the conference commissioner's mouth so far is their goal is to get the top 4 teams in the not yeah, but they won. They went undefeated. It wasn't that. It was the top four teams. That's it. So what we have to rely on, and I don't know what the system's going to be, if it's a selection committee with a computer, whatever it's going to be, we have to rely on whatever system they put in place to be able to collectively make a kind of a guesstimation about who those top four teams are. And if an undefeated MAC team or Conference USA team or WAC team, or even for that matter, Big East team, if they get left out, then, you know, that's the process, you know, and that's what we have to trust, and that's what we have to rely on.
It just seems tough if the reason you're implementing the playoffs, though, is to sort of erode the subjective nature of this, that you almost have to have.
But how is it eroding that?
Well, because, you know, if there's a situation where there's three undefeated teams, as, you know, it happened that one year with, like, USC, Texas, and Auburn, the idea that we have to decide which of those two teams play, well, that would be gone. That would be a great year for that. I think in years when there's multiple undefeated teams, that this will be a less subjective way of doing it, but that doesn't really happen that often.
No, I think what the example that you gave is dead on. I think you might get one, you know, typical year you might get one team from the SEC undefeated, or you might get two from the SEC with one loss, you know, and more than likely they'll both be in there. And then you're going to be looking at a bunch of one-loss teams, and maybe that one year that there's a team kind of on the outside who's undefeated. I mean, I think that might be more than likely that's going to be the what we're going to be looking at on a annual basis.
Do you think it will get expanded to 8 or even 16?
I don't think so.
If they have big success, I mean, if these games are extremely highly rated, which I think is pretty inevitable.
Yeah. I. You know what? I mean, aren't they going to? This thing's going to be a 12-year deal, right?
I don't know.
That's what I'm hearing. I mean, they're talking about a really long-term deal. So, you know, unless they can somehow get into it 4 years later and say, oh, by the way, we want to go to 8 now. I don't know. I think they'll go to. I think it'll settle in at 4, regardless of what the feedback is. And I think that's where it'll be for at least a decade or so.
The last thing I want to ask you about, I guess it's not really a personal question, semi-personal. When you go to these various towns week to week, you know, to do these games and do, you know, game day live and stuff, what is your life like when you're there? Because to me, if I could have dinner with any media person in the world, it would be Brent Musburger. I think that would be the most fun person to have drinks with and just listen to. So I'm wondering, do you guys, like, go out together a lot? Or are you there just pretty much watching film the whole time and preparing to be on TV? Is it fun outside of the games?
Yeah, well, your hunch about having dinner with Brent Musburger is exactly right.
It would seem like it would be great. And it would also seem like it would be, in a way, preparing for the game, because I'm sure all he does is, like, talk about sports. He talks about NASCAR. And it's like his 8th favorite sport, and he seems like he knows everything about it.
I know. I mean, I could sit there and listen to him just because, you know, I'm a huge fan of his. And, you know, he goes back to, you know, especially my wheelhouse of going back to the latter part of the 70s with the Redskins and the Cowboys and into the 80s, you know. I mean, I used to watch him so much. So for me, you know, we typically will try to go out to dinner on a Thursday night when we get on campus. And, you know, with me doing College Game Day.
Like, where do you go?
We'll just find a local, like, a steakhouse and get into a – usually there's a room somewhere in the steakhouse where a lot of times we'll go that has a TV, because we're always looking to try to watch the Thursday night game. So we'll get into a room where there's a TV and have a great time, you know, and I just sit and listen. that's my job, kind of like what you were alluding to. But it's a good chance to build chemistry and kind of build rapport, I think, with the entire crew, which is a lot of fun.
So how many college games do you watch a week, and how many live college games do you watch?
I probably watch 5 monitors at a time for the noon hour and the 3:30 hour. So that's 10. And then the game that I call, and we usually have a game or two that's up in the booth that you're able to kind of keep track of what's going on with those other games. So, and then whatever game I happen to miss, or, you know, a relevant game, I always go back and either have it TiVo'd or ability to pull it up online. So I, you know, I don't know, 12, 14.
Do you then watch all the pro games on Sunday?
Not as much. The older I've gotten, the more I've become the, I'm a Cincinnati Bengals fan, so that kind of tells you about my pro football, you know, career as a fan, and I don't do fantasy. So I'll watch the Bengals until they're mathematically eliminated, even though they had a good year last year. And then I've become like the Joe Buck, Troy Aikman, 4 o'clock Eastern Fox game, mm-hmm. occasionally. And definitely will watch the Sunday night and the Monday night game because I think that's the only atmosphere in the regular season that comes close to rivaling college football. It's hard for me to be around the college game and the emotion and passion and then tune into a 1 o'clock Eastern NFL game. It's very, very different.
Do you watch the Tuesday night game then?
Tuesday night
is usually a Mac game, right?
Oh, I'll watch those. Yeah. I'm sick enough to watch those, yeah.
Do you watch the high school game they usually show on Wednesday?
No, I don't. I usually have to draw the line somewhere. And if there's a hot prospect or somebody sends me something about a guy, I'll watch that. But usually I'm literally, I hate to sound boring, but if I'm awake from mid-August to early January, I'm either doing something for college football on air or I'm talking to someone like yourself or I'm on the phone with coach.
I would guess it would be a pretty immersive life, but I was just, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
what will you do if one of your kids becomes a really good high school quarterback? Will you stop traveling every weekend to watch him play?
Man, that is a great question. I don't know. I won't. Let me put it this way. I plan on not missing if they happen to go along and play at that level. I mean, I can't imagine missing out on that part of their lives. I'm already missing. They play on Saturday mornings, and I'm already missing those games. So that's one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, as crazy as that might sound.
Well, no, it must be very strange because I'm sure just based on what you do for a living and your life, like football must be a very central part of your relationship with these kids. You know, you must talk about sports with them all the time. How do you feel? Like, was your dad at all your games growing up?
No, it was a different time, though. My parents divorced when I was about 8 years old. And so, you know, I sometimes I'd play games when neither parent would be there. Sometimes I'd play games and one of them would be there or both. But it wasn't as if, you know, my parents were at every single thing that I did. And yet I, on the other hand, I really, really, really try to be there for everything that they do.
You know, it seemed like eight would have been theoretically the worst possible age to have your parents divorce.
Yeah, it was tough, really tough.
How confused were you by it, or were you aware what was going on?
I kind of was oblivious. I just knew that once I had an older brother and an older sister, and once we moved out with my mom, I realized that I wasn't seeing my dad, you know, as often, except on weekends, and that kind of bummed me out. But you just, you know, you don't. I didn't blame myself or anything like that. I think some kids go through that. I didn't do that. I think what I did, honestly, is I immersed myself in sports. You know, I think that sports really became my outlet, both as a participant and as a viewer. I mean, that I was a junkie, 100% from the time I can remember. I was a junkie, and I always tell people when I was a teenager driving, you know, to the parties with my buddies, if they were in the car with me, we were listening to WLW, you know, Bob Trumpy and Chris Collinsworth doing the talk show, or listening to the Reds play baseball. I mean, I was just, that was my thing. I didn't really listen to music. I didn't really do a whole lot of other things. I just, that was kind of my, as I said, my outlet for maybe, you know, some of the pain that I was going through as a kid.
Well, I'll tell you what, I appreciate you talking to me today. It was really interesting, and, you know, have a great job getting drunk with Brent Musburger this year.
You got it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
See ya.
So I get to sign off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.